White Rocket Entertainment.
You're listening to the ESO Network, your station for all things geek.
10, 9, 8, 7, ignition sequence started. All engines are started. We have ignition, 2, 1, 0, we have a liftoff. We have a liftoff and it's lighting up the area. It's just like daylight here at Kennedy Space Center. The Saturn V is moving off the pad. It is now clear of the tower.
Hello and welcome to the White Rocket Podcast, brought to you by White Rocket Books in association with the Earth Station One Network. It's one long conversation with a variety of guests about the best of popular culture. I'm Van Allen Plexico. On this episode, I present the panel from just a few days ago in Chicago at the Windy City Pulp and Paperback Convention. This is one of the New Pulp Sunday panels. And it features a discussion of where we pulp writers get our inspiration and our ideas that we use in our books and stories. The various panelists who are on there alongside me will be introducing themselves at the very beginning of this episode, and so I'll leave it to them to do so. And I hope you enjoy it. So here we go with New Pulp Sunday at Windy City Pulp and Paperback Convention 2016. Where do we get our inspirations and ideas? This is panel number 3, and clearly the best and most important one. Pulp writing, the creative process. Where do you go for ideas and inspiration? Now, before we introduce ourselves, I just got to say, I don't know why we're even going to spend an hour on this, because there's that shop in New Jersey that everybody goes to for your ideas, right? You give them $5, they give you an idea, exactly. You're good. I don't. What's to discuss?
Technically, they also have a satellite that's Dayton Madison here in Chicago.
Nice.
Oh, I didn't know.
Okay, so you don't even have to.
That's my Tinder.
You don't even have to go far, right? So, but I guess some people get their ideas in other places, so we're going to talk about that. So let's let the. I'm Van Plexico, and I'm your moderator. Let me introduce myself real quick. I'm the owner of White Rocket Books, but I also write for a number of other publishers, including Airship 27, Pro Se. I'm probably best known as the author of the Sentinel Superhero series and the Shattering Space Opera series, but I've done a lot of other stuff too. And I also host the White Rocket Podcast, which is a pop culture discussion show, as well as a football show that you care nothing about. And so I won't go there. And I'm also a history and political science professor at Southwestern Illinois. Okay, now let's start on this end and let everybody introduce themselves.
I'm Jeff Fournier. I'm a writer. I've done nonfiction, fiction articles for magazines. I've also done for Airship 27. I was in their Sinbad, and I was also in the Legends of New Pulp Fiction. And I'm also working with another person at the table here, Andy Fix. We're doing the Global Adventure Society Pulpcast, which is a podcast we're doing about anything related to pulp, books, movies, TV, comics, etc.
I'm Andy Fix. I also write for Airship 27, have a few stories for them, and also for Pro Se Productions. Speaking to your podcast, I'm actually a former professional football player, so I would be interested in your podcast.
Excellent.
You said that, I was like, look at Andy.
Right.
Like,
very good.
I'm Fred Adams. I write for Airship 27 and for Pro Se, among others. And my series include the Hit Wolf series, Six Gun Terrors, the C.O. Jones, and the Sam Dunn novels. And I just finished a nonfiction book entitled 20 Frets, No Nets, A Guide for the Solo Guitarist.
Very cool.
Fred, I have to say, I've read the Hit Wolf and your Weird West ones, and I love them. So.
Oh, bless your heart. Thank you. That means I don't have to engage in shameless self-promotion.
My name's, on the books, it's B.C. Bell. You can call me Chris. I'm the author and creator of the Tales of the Bagman series. The science fiction, horror, psychological, Bipolar Express, and I've done an Avengers story for Moonstone, too. Boy, as far as that's what I've done, I mean, that's pretty much my whole intro.
Well, cool. The thing that's always that's neat about Chris usually going by BC is that usually when people go by their initials like that, it turns out to be a woman who's trying to not alienate guy readers who don't want to read a woman writer. So when I first met Chris, I'm like, hey, you're a guy. How about that? Doesn't matter at all, but it was just surprising somehow.
Plot
I don't
twist.
Know. Yeah, it was a plot twist. Very good.
I thought BC looked cool on the
spine. Yeah, it does. Well, every time, not a convention goes by that somebody doesn't come up to me and ask me where I came up with this made-up name, Van Allen Plexico, and I have to show them my driver's license. But it seems to happen all the time. So, well, we are gathered here today to talk about making, about the creative process, where we go for ideas and inspiration, because the other panels will talk about specific things. But here I wanted to talk about Where does the beginning of those things come from? In other words, how do you go from having no idea, nothing in front of you, no project you're working on, to suddenly having some great idea and pushing it forward to completion? What sort of things inspire you? So why don't we go down the line again? And this time we'll talk about like the main things that really get you wanting to rush to the keyboard. So,
okay.
Jeff, you want to go ahead and kick us off?
I just kind of find it in real life usually. I usually go by people's experience, especially my own, obviously. But you get to start talking to people and you get their experiences, and you can kind of see something in that later on you'll want to pursue. The story I created for the Legends of New Pope with the new character I created called the Printer's Devil, I used to work in a print shop, and all of that stuff he had about how to foil counterfeiters and that sort of thing, It was just stuff I picked up over the course of talking with people. And even the legend of the Printer's Devil, the actual character, was based on a pressman superstition that I had encountered one time at a place I worked at. So you kind of just can find it anywhere. You just have to look at something and take it out of context and mess around with how it goes together, you know.
Hmm. You know, I think that there's several that I can think of and we can talk about over the course of the thing, but there's no single, I mean, certainly you go to movies, you go, oh, I could do something like that. You know, you read a book and go, oh, I want to do something like that, or that makes me think something else. But I don't think there's any single activity I do that gets me more inspired and wanting to run straight to the keyboard than going in like a Barnes & Noble and just looking at the shelves. And when I start seeing all the books there and how cool they look and I read the backs and think how interesting they are, that gets my blood flowing more than almost any other activity I can think of, because I'm like, you know, I have another one like that in me. Now, that's not a specific, right? So we can talk about specific inspirations too. But just in general, in terms of getting you wanting to write and get to the keyboard, that's the main thing for me. What
about you too? Well, I think that it certainly helps if you're a writer that you're a little bit weird, because you look at life a little bit differently and things hit you a little bit differently. So I'm more along the lines of Jeff. I get a lot of stuff. I read a lot. I read a lot of. I follow the news. Mm. I read articles. I read, watch documentaries, the whole nine yards. And anything that makes me go, hey, that's pretty cool, I will then that just plants a seed in my head. And when I'm not thinking about it, it starts growing and. So anything that makes me think of something as cool, I'll start digging into that and what makes that cool, and then a story grows from that.
Very good.
My experience is very similar. John Updike, the American novelist, said that a writer must read at least three times as much as he writes. I agree wholeheartedly. Mm-hmm. I'm an omnivorous reader, and I like to read about odd facts, strange things. You read a book, things you didn't know about the Civil War, and suddenly this one item stands out and it becomes the basis for a story. You attach it to a couple of characters and run with it. My characters, you know, they're conjoined twins, they're Chinese, they're the Smith brothers in San Francisco in the 1890s. I'm reading about Chang and Eng, reading a book on human oddities. And, of course, they're prominent. And I ask myself the question, which is the great question of all writers, what if they were born into a wealthy family rather than being sold to a circus when they were 10? What if they had the advantage of culture, education, and advantage and privilege? And from that then grew the characters, and from there I then developed the story, which is going to come out. I did it as a NaNoWriMo, as one of those write a novel in 1 month things. It's The Eye of Quang Chi. Ron promises me it will see daylight before the next 50 years. Someday it will be out. But that's how I get started. Just one odd thing or another, and then you ask yourself, what if?
I kind of hard to follow up on that. A lot, like they said, the historical idea. I read a lot about old pulp writers because there's a lot of inspiration in these guys hammering out a million words a year, which is something I could not do. I mean, I could, but none of it would be publishable. Other places, some of the science fiction I do, I kind of do that Philip K. Dick where I'm trying to answer questions about stuff that's happened to me. And that's where I get into the psychological horror stuff, or I say, well, what if, you know, it was really just all aliens? That kind of thing. The inspiration for the Bagman, you got to be a little weird. I was in recovery. I was the senior resident at the 12-step house, basically a halfway house. And I had basically said, I want to create a pulp character that could be in Black Mask magazine, because they never had a masked guy. And I slipped some humor in there, which they weren't really allowed to do unless they were Norbert Davis. And but then one guy in the halfway house, his dad had been a racketeer. And this guy had literally been sent to break his own uncle's legs. And I was like, that's the beginning of my story. Well, you got somewhere you quit the mob. And now I'm on the third book, so it was a pretty good idea, I guess. You know, and I'll be on the fourth one, the one I'm working on now. It was one of those aliens things where I said, you know, what if it's like none of this is real and other dimensions are just like fighting to get in all the time, so that our reality's really changing and we don't even notice it because stuff just falls into place. It's like a time stream. And so the next one's going to get complicated because we've got 9 different dimensions and the dream world, and it won't be one of my hard-boiled crime things. It'll be more of a, you know, how did we get here, and oh my God, how are we going to get out? And there's going to be a big alien bug too, so you won't get bored.
Thank God, yes. Well, Chris, you turned the corner very smoothly there into the next thing I was going to mention, is when we come back the other way then and talk about a specific thing that maybe occurs to you and where you got the inspiration for that. We could hit, like, you know, one of your favorite things and how did it come to you. Fred, what do you think?
Well, C.O. Jones grew out of people I actually knew. C.O. Jones is set in post-World War II Brownsville, Pennsylvania, where my uncle ran Brownsville for the mob for about 15 or 20 years. You cannot invent the kinds of circumstances that I saw when I was growing up. Example, they operated out of a pool room on the ground floor. Second floor was a boxing gym, and the third and fourth floors were sealed off. The third floor had a gambling casino. The fourth floor was the offices and where they processed all the number slips on huge tables. The reason those things were on the third and fourth floor was that the fire department's hook and ladder truck only reached the second floor and the police could not raid them. You cannot invent
stuff like
this.
That. Yeah, exactly.
C.O. Jones is based on a man who will remain nameless. He's dead now. He was shot 3 times at close range with a 12-gauge shotgun and did not die for 6 hours. He was an OSS assassin. And after he left the war, he went to work for the only thing he was trained to do, kill people. He went to work for the mob as a hitman. And this was the beginning of C.O. Jones. And I decided to throw an extra ringer in there. Jones was also part of an elite unit of the OSS trained to go after the Nazis who were accumulating magical books and magical talismans and things like that as part of Hitler's occult war effort. And, of course, all that catches up with him when he shows up in Brownsville and goes to work for the local boys. That's, you know, that you just take something you know and run with it.
Mm-hmm. Well, for me, I think it would be the story that Jeff and I just wrapped up for Airship 27. Airship was putting together an Air Aces anthology, and Jeff and I were thinking of what we could possibly do for that. And I've always been a big buff of World War II, the old the warplanes. So the P-61 jumped out at me.
The Black Widow.
Black Widow. I thought that was a really cool plane.
And it's such a crazy plane, too.
Right. Like
when they designed it, nobody bought into the concept as quick because they couldn't imagine a bomber that was a night fighter that used radar that would actually outperform some fighters.
Right.
It's like you were saying with your uncle who was the OSS assassin who was a mobster. It's just such a weird combination. You can't make it up. And then you start scratching the surface and start to come up with, oh my God, this thing is crazy.
Yeah.
You know, once you start looking in, then you start talking. Like we were talking to my dad in the story, there's a mission they're going on and they have to use the radar extensively. And this was high-tech radar back in the day, probably the best. And then my dad used to work he was in the Air Force, and he used to work as a radar radio technician. And I asked him, I said, well, we're trying to make sure this story has enough excitement. You think that using the radar would be possible to use it for this mission? And he turned to me and he goes, it would make the Death Star trench run look like a cakewalk. So it's totally got enough. He's like, yep, you could do it, but man, it's going to be just wrought with tension. It's just going to be that much more ratchet up. So you find these little things like that you get from the...
The research that I did for that story was so much fun. Just reading up on all the planes, and I visited the United States Air Force Museum, which is just north of where I live in Cincinnati. Just spent hours there, just taking notes, taking pictures, stuff like that.
I had to go grill me. I was at a gun show, and the guy was selling old war memorabilia, and he had like World War II stuff. And I said, "Oh yeah, P-61." He goes, "Yeah, P-61." I said, "Yeah, 2 Pratt and Whitney engines." He goes, "Yeah, 35,000 tons of Pratt." And we started matching stuff back and forth. And he goes, "How did you know so much?" I said, "Well, I do research. I'm writing a story about it." And he was like, "What? He didn't think anyone wrote stories like that anymore." I was kind of surprised.
Anymore? That's a very good point. And we'll talk about that. We talk about about pulp and where it is and where it's going. I got three little quick ones I'll throw out to you just that occurred to me off the top of my head. First, when I was writing I've done 2 stories about the Griffin, which is Kerry Keene, sort of a 1930s, almost a sort of a Batman figure. He's rich. He puts on a black costume, goes out at night, goes after bad guys, but he does it in his plane, his black seaplane, right? So he has a hangar in his mansion that comes out like the car coming out of the Batcave. His seaplane comes out of the cliff. Well, I was trying to think who would be a good matchup for this character. And I was just doing research, digging around through Wikipedia and stuff, and I found out about they're translated as vipers. They were these planes. I'm doing air quotes for our listening audience. They're about as much airplanes as an unguided missile is an airplane. The Nazis built these rocket planes that had a rocket engine on the back and about a dozen rockets that blow up on the front, and a pilot, and we could call him a pilot, he could also be just cargo or unlucky son of a gun, right? They launch it in the sky like Evel Knievel in his rocket plane, his, you know, thing, and then they shoot their rockets at the enemy, and now I got to figure out a way to not die. So part of the plane falls away, and the other part pops out a parachute, and they land, and that's the entire flight. And I said, "This," and this was the best part. The Luftwaffe took one look at this and said, "We're not putting our pilots in these things. That's ridiculous." So the SS flew them because they were the only Nazis crazy enough to want to do that. And I said, "I've got to use that." So that was one. That was one inspiration. Another one, real quick, was when I was writing this book here, The Shattering. I wanted to do kind of a Warhammer 40,000 Horus Heresy thing of my own, but I needed an inspiration that would make it different. You know, something to give it. Inspiration. And again, I was, as a history professor, I turned to I've got a 3-volume History of the Byzantine Empire by Lord Norwich, and very early on he talks about the Emperor Constantine. This is the kind of stuff that just blows your mind. The Emperor Constantine and his entire imperial retinue from Rome went to Nicaea, where they held the Nicene Council and wrote the Nicene Creed and all that. We know this, right? When on the way back to Rome, somewhere along the way, Constantine slaughtered his entire family. Just murdered his wife and children and everything, because he's a Roman emperor and they do crazy crap like that. And I'm like, okay, there's a story there, right? I mean, there's got to be a reason. I said, well, of course, he's possessed by, you know, alternate dimension demons. So now I've got my my story, right? Of course. And then the last one real quick is the new one I'm about to work on. I'm not going to give away too much about it, but I checked out a book at the library last week on the Pacific War. Ian Toll's writing this awesome trilogy about the Pacific, World War II in the Pacific, which doesn't get as much press, you know, as much ink as the Nazis do. And just the prologue alone, he talked about a crazy Scottish aristocrat who got stationed on an island in the South Pacific and had to deal with the Japanese coming, showing up. And I said, there's a pulp novel if there ever was one. Okay, so that's all I'll say about that. But so I kind of turn to history and find either in a historical story itself or inspiration for a science fiction or fantasy story. So did you have another one you want to do?
The Printer's Devil one would be more of the closest one I had to finding something that was inspiring. I used to work at a print shop in the print industry, and they would run the offset press, and we would run the modern electronic stuff. And one of the old pressmen was Mike. And he would get frustrated when the flexographic wasn't working right or whatever. And one time I saw him, he went and he dusted off this old, gnarly statue this big of a devil sitting on a book, looking at a book. And I was like, what the hell is that? And he goes, he uses a doorstop, it's a printer's devil. And he puts it on the door, and he goes out and takes a smoke. And I'm like, a printer's devil's the guy who runs the old linotype. That's what they used to call the little kids when they'd run the type around. And he goes, no, this is something else. I said, what is it? Because I'd never heard of this. And he goes, well, back in the old days, when the machine was working bad, the guy would get frustrated. They would stop, and they'd make sure the printer's devil was outside the shop. It usually involved them opening the door, going outside, and that would probably chase the humidity of the paper or the ink, clear the shop out, and maybe the press would run better. So he says, yeah, you got to put the printer's devil out of the shop, or else things will go wrong. So I said, okay, what if there was a guy who his specialty was making things go wrong for criminals? And I was like, well, I like the print aspect of it. How am I going to do this? And, well, okay, he screws with counterfeiters. Not just guys who make funny money, but anything that they're swindling. Like they make fake stock deeds or fake land deeds or fake art or manufacture weird things that are not the thing that they're stealing from somebody. And I said, what is this guy? It's like, he grew up and he was a mechanical genius because he worked in a press shop and he worked for mobs. He was a little kid, and his mentor showed him all this stuff. And then, of course, mob backlash happens, and his mentor gets killed. And he realizes that he's involved, even tacitly as a little kid, is involved in all this bad stuff. And he doesn't want to do that anymore. So he knows all these ways to counterfeit stuff. So he counterfeits his way into blackmailing the mobsters, getting a ton of money, sending them to jail. And then he gets himself a college education and becomes educated. And he becomes a manufacturer, and he becomes a millionaire. But he still feels like he still has to pay penance for what he did as a little kid, contributing to these people's woes. So he makes this identity of the printer's devil, this devil-faced, tuxedo-clad maniac who basically goes out and hunts down criminals who counterfeit stuff. Before, in 1930 Chicago, before there was a Secret Service doing that sort of thing really heavily, and he basically goes out there and starts, you know, hunting them, and it becomes like almost a supernatural. He's messing with their legendary. And I'd never heard of that legend of the printer's devil. with the doorstop statue and everything like that, but it was a real thing. And I personally met a guy, and he personally told me about the whole superstition. And I've never found it anywhere on the net or anything like that. So it just must be one of those things that gets passed around to people. And I think that's the thing you find. You find that in real life, there's a lot of people that you scratch the surface, and all of a sudden you find out, oh yeah, so-and-so was the guy that worked on Eddie Rickenbacker's plane when they did the raid in Tokyo. And you're like, what? And all of a sudden, history hits you. You have a touchstone, and that kind of gives you the inspiration.
That's awesome. Okay.
One other thing that occurs to me I could ask you guys, and then we can take some questions from the audience in the second half, if you guys have some, is there something that you wish inspired you, something you wish you could do or you'd like to do, some genre or some type of character story, but you're just not really sure you have, that it's in your wheelhouse? Like, is it... I'll go back down to Chris. What out there inspires you, but you're like, oh, but I don't know if I could pull it off.
Oh,
if anything.
Right now, and I've done it before, but I'm considering writing another Western.
Mm-hmm.
And the whole idea is finding those plot holes you can't drive stagecoach through, because it's been done so many times. And once again, I'm taking inspiration from history. P.J. Pretorius, you probably don't know who he is, used to be a part of Africa called Pretoria. He was a Dutchman, and the Germans came along in World War I and said, you don't own your land anymore. And he said, well, I'm at war with Germany. And this guy was a badass. He was like blowing up submarines and all by himself. You know, he had pulp hero. But I thought, what if you did that to somebody on the Texas-Mexico border? And since I like characters who aren't always the most honest, I said, he'd become a smuggler. And so right now I'm just kind of working all that out. And, you know, and then next will be like the Foreign Legion story or something. You know, it just, these things gather in the back of your head, and eventually it has to come out, or I'll be even weirder.
It's a form of therapy, then. It's a form of therapy to work through these things, the demons, and get them out, literally in this case. Fred, what do you think?
Well, the big challenge for me right now, and I'm doing a lot of reading and watching documentaries and other things, I was surprised to learn, again, watching, I watch a lot of nonfiction documentary stuff, again, just for odd ideas. I was watching James Burke's Connections, which I picked up on DVD. I recommend it to everybody. And in one episode, he talked about how shipping and nautical engineering and other things affected the outcomes in the clear to the 20th century. But he threw out one fact that I thought was interesting. Lloyd's of London began indemnifying cargoes in the mid-1700s. So here comes the new character, Featherstone of Lloyd's, an insurance investigator who was a kind of 18th century James Bond, who gets to fight with pirates, smugglers, corrupt government officials, sea monsters, and anything else I can dig out. But it is a daunting task, because I know zero about, well, I know a little more than when I started, but about British sailing ships and the Royal Yes. Navy and things like that. It'll take some time, and it'll take some research, but I'll get there eventually.
Now, for me, it's kind of the opposite. I mentioned that I used to be a professional football player, and being on the road with those guys was quite a treat as a player and then later as a coach. So the sports stories, you know, the pulp sports stories, I'm always fascinated by, and I love reading them. I love the Robert E. Howard boxing stories and all that, but I just don't know how to translate those, my life experiences, into like a pulp story type thing. So that's something I want to try. It's definitely a challenge, but that's a little intimidating.
Yeah, I know what you mean. I feel like there's a... I've done several nonfiction books on college football, and I do a podcast on college football, and I feel like there's a Murder at the Iron Bowl novel waiting to be written, but I just don't think I can do it. But somebody's going to do it, you know.
Alabama fan.
Oh, I was going to say, we're lucky there's not a Murder at the Iron Bowl every year, more than one, but, you know.
C4 on the helmet.
Yeah. Well, I think that the thing that really I wish I was able to do that really does inspire me all the time, I've read the entire Parker, which is Richard Stark, Donald Westlake's Parker crime novels. And in fact, I was hoping to talk to Levi Stahl, who's the editor for University of Chicago Press, while I was here this weekend, but he's not available. But we're going to do the White Rocket show in a couple of weeks. So if you check out the White Rocket podcast coming up in the next few weeks or so, I'm going to be talking to the guy who brought Parker back in print, and I'm very excited about that. He's really cool. But reading the Parker books, and then also I've been reading Michael Connelly, you know, the Bosch and Lincoln Lawyer books, and watching the show. And talk about finding inspiration, you know, watching Titus Welliver as Bosch and Matthew McConaughey as his half-brother, the Lincoln Lawyer, Mickey Haller. I would just love, I mean, and to do that. And the thing that's frustrating to me is, that stuff seems on the surface so much easier to write than stuff like this that I actually do write. I mean, this is like galactic empires and demons and giant galactic war. This is just a detective solving a crime. And yet, I don't think I'm much more comfortable over here in Star Wars land than I am, you know, with McConaughey and Welliver. And I don't know why that is.
That's interesting you say that, because the one for me is Sherlock Holmes.
I've done that.
Which
I've done
Holmes. If Andy knows me, and if you don't know, I used to be a private investigator.
Okay.
For a little while, and they do security consulting, that sort of thing. And trying to make sure that I could do justice to try to write a Sherlock Holmes is so daunting to me. I don't think I could. I sit there and go, oh, this is laughable. Holmes will see through this in a half second, and the reader will see it through, because so many of the Holmes readers are just,
it's
riveted,
hard.
And they will figure it out before you're two pages in. And I'm like, I got to make sure I give them something that they're going to enjoy. But I don't want to sit there and pull, oh, yeah, and look, he had this the whole time and he never told you. Wah, wah. I hate it.
There are two things I'll say about that. One, when I got to write, I wrote two of the five stories in Airship 27's first Sherlock Holmes book.
Yeah.
And the reason I did, the only reason, was because I had just totally coincidentally just read the entire Arthur Conan Doyle canon. It was, I had just like closed the book, and the next day Ron Fortier says, hey, we're doing Sherlock Holmes, you know, something. If it had been a year later, I'd have been like, no, it's gone. It's gone, yeah. Right? But my memory banks were so jammed with it that I said, I can channel that one time. Well, I wrote the story, and it was half as long as Ron needed. And I'm like, well, I don't want to flesh it out more and make it, you know, I don't want to make it too thin. So I said, all right, I'll do one more. And I wrote another short one. And then Ron's like, are you going to do volume two? I'm like, I'm done. I poured it all in there. I've dumped it out. And then I shook it up and dumped it out again. And I'm done, you know. So
and when you see these other, like, you read about the big pro authors who have done whole huge novels.
Yeah,
the guy's
like,
so I taught myself over 2.5 years every version of phrasing that Holmes used in his stories.
Right.
So that when I was writing, I was actually writing the way a Victorian person would speak and talk. And I'm like, oh my God. And then you start to realize, well, you really kind of would need to do that a little bit to make it sound correct, because you can't have Holmes say, that's cool.
Right.
Or something.
Well, that's what I mean is, because I had just read all of them, it was enough in my brain that I didn't have to go, like, I could hear it. But if any amount of time had passed, I wouldn't have heard it anymore, you know. So
One of the problems, too, is I'm an iconoclast, and I wanted to write non-canonical Holmes, which many people think is a sacrilege. But I had there are two of them coming out in a small volume from Prose, and one of them I had this idea in the 1970s and never been able to do anything with it. The one thing that Holmes probably could not solve would be if Wells' time traveler showed up and started messing with reality day to day as Holmes is trying to investigate something. Hence the story, The Affair of the Chronic Argonaut. in which to prove he told the truth, the time traveler returns with a Morlock in captivity and it gets away and starts a series of grisly cannibal murders in the newly constructed and under-constructed underground railroad, mm-hmm. railway nice. In London. And I had great fun with that one.
How could you not?
But I came up with that idea in the 1970s when I was still teaching high school.
Wow.
And it just hung around and hung around. I was going to send it to Nicholas Meyer as a suggestion, who did the 7% solution and the mm-hmm. Red Hook Horror.
Mm-hmm.
And I just never got around to it, and I finally ended up writing it myself.
Well, it's also reminiscent of Time After Time.
Yeah.
Which is a great story. A great, very pulpy story. So, that's cool. Did everybody get a turn on the last one? I want to make sure. Did Chris?
Yeah, Sherlock Holmes, I ran from.
Yeah.
No, they know the character too well. I don't.
That's the thing with Holmes, is that almost everybody loves him, but yet you know you either have it or you don't. You know, it's either in your wheelhouse or it's not. You know.
I'm in his school because I want to write about the cocaine. I want him solving a case and then just collapsing at the end, you know, having to go to the hospital, that kind of thing.
Well, I was thinking that, and then this made, I don't...
The doctor actually has to treat him.
Fred, the setup that you gave, I was just thinking, if the circumstances kept being changed underneath Holmes's feet... He would have to ultimately conclude
that there was a time travel.
That there was something. Well, not necessarily that, because he's going to read
the novel.
Yeah.
Among the people present, there is an unnamed physician who was Watson.
Right.
Watson was there, tells Holmes, "I saw the most remarkable thing." So Holmes is aware that this is in the wind. And finally, they figure out what's going on.
I'm thinking he would just retreat to drugs, like Chris was saying. I mean, he'd just be like, this is not something I can deal with. I'm going to go find my, you know.
This is a challenge he could not step away from because it just was so so alien.
Right.
Something that how in the world, you know, we're working on this supposition, and then something shows up in their flat that wasn't there an hour before. And no one has been there.
Right.
And how did it get there? And things like that. And creating an insoluble problem. And that was the fun of it.
Yeah.
And he'd have to go to, like, philosophers and Freud to solve this case, you know.
Yeah, because you wouldn't be getting anything any other way.
I would just come in laughing and pointing.
I just came over.
Well, no, it wasn't quite like that.
Well, let's see if you guys have got like 20 minutes left. Any questions that we haven't? We've hit on a few things here, but I'm sure there's lots more. Everybody think for a second. Or if you guys have anything, by all means.
We'll ask you questions.
Yeah. What's your most creative character? What's the character you heard that's the most creative? What any media, any movie, TV? What's the one you like?
If you would want
that was the most creative character.
Yeah, what would you want us to do?
Do you need another book from?
I want somebody to step up and do more Parker books. I mean, it's a tough thing because it could be done badly, and then everybody's like, "Oh, why is somebody, you know, dragging that out? They should leave it alone." But I want more. I'm sorry, you know, I've never been one of these people that gets mad when they try to somebody else tries to carry on the stuff. I'm like, fine, let's see if it's any good. Yeah.
It could be like George Lazenby doing James Bond.
Hey, that was the best part.
That was good.
Yeah, did you see where Dan Simmons?
Yeah.
Did the
Drood
Hard Freeze?
Oh.
It's basically a character that's Parker.
Oh, okay.
The first book, Hard Freeze, is amazing.
Okay.
The second two, he proves he is no Donald Westlake. He has to have
you are.
To come in and, you know.
Donald Westlake writing is like Jimmy Page playing the guitar. It seems simple on the surface, but when you really try to figure it out, you're like, oh.
Yeah.
I'd like to see more Saint
stories.
Saint was awesome.
Yeah.
Who?
The Saint?
Simon Templar.
Yeah.
Who did that? I mean, I know the TV show and everything, but were there books? Was there a...
Yeah, there was books.
They mostly came out as pulp stories. A lot of them were published in England, and so there's not a whole lot of novel-length Saint stuff.
Yeah, they're very similar to the Quiller character. Adam, what's his last name? Read the Quiller novels. The same kind of British stoicism and hail fellow well met kind of stuff. They're entertaining, but they are dated.
Right.
Right.
I'm just mulling this in my head because,
it's come up with a story idea right now.
Well, like an example where they did carry it on was because the Zelazny estate, you know, has its issues internally. And so when Roger Zelazny died young and we didn't get any more Amber books, and so, you know, part of his family says, part of his family said the only people that could continue this would either be Neil Gaiman or Stephen Bruce, who are the two Zelazny acolytes that you've heard of. I'm one too, but you haven't heard of me. And they both said, we'll never do that out of respect for Roger. The other part of the family says, well, let's just find somebody that will, that doesn't have those scruples, right? And so they went and got Betancourt to do three prequels. And they went over about like a certain other three prequels that we can think of went over where, you know, if you really wanted more of that, it's in there. But, you know, so sometimes that is a, you know, sometimes it's a good thing and sometimes it's just making bad memories on top of good ones, I guess. So.
One of the dangers when you do that, the original artist brings so much of their own vision to the material. Another writer may see that material and say, hey, well, that looks cool. How about if I do this, this, or this? But it's so different from the original vision that it doesn't carry that same feel, that same vibe.
Or if they try so hard to make it like a carbon copy that it just seems like a cheap carbon copy.
Yeah, that too. Soulless.
You find that with the people who are writing Parker's characters now. Picked up Spencer and just.
Well, that's the other Parker. There's two Parker. There's Parker the character. You're talking about Parker the author.
B. Parker.
Right. That's right.
The author is Spencer.
Do you know who writes the new Spencer books?
I'm straining to remember.
Ace Atkins, who went to college with me. He was a defensive lineman on Auburn's 1990. There you go, Gene. He was a defensive lineman that sacked Danny Werfel when we upset Florida. And he was telling everybody that would listen back then, oh, I've got an unpublished like crime novel, and everybody like, oh, the football player with the crime novel, what an idiot. And now he's like junior what's his name that wrote The Firm, you know, I mean, he lives on a farm in Mississippi just like, you know, what's the guy's name,
Grisham.
Yeah, he's like Grisham Jr. He lives on a farm in Mississippi and cranks out these great crime novels and stuff.
Yeah.
So he got the last laugh there. Yes, ma'am.
One thing I would like to see more, they are coming out, but of course they would come out faster, is more novels of the Red Panda or Blackjack Justice from Decoder Ring Theater.
I've heard of that, but not.
Yeah. No,
it's an audio drama.
The Red Panda. I've listened to Red Panda. That's a lot of fun. I like the Red Panda.
I've heard very good things about
that.
It's not Wolverine?
No.
If he is named after an animal, creator two, and you know, I can only do so much. So,
yes.
You guys, what gets me is being married to someone who writes versus someone who arcs the kind of person who both finishes and things like that. When I read something, I like to be able to visualize what's going on, and I find that very fascinating. But I also find that the process that you go through. You know, the thought process more than even putting the pen to paper process is so different than from a visual artistic way of doing things. I see it and I gotta get it out now, so I'm gonna lose it. I mean, I gotta get it on the wall, or I gotta get it on someone's walls before I lose it. And it's just the process of how you guys come up with your stories, your inspirations, the techniques fascinates me.
See, and that's interesting because a friend of mine named Stephen Savage, real name. Probably no relation to that. He wrote a book called The Power of Creative Paths, and he had me like proofread it a month ago. And basically, he was trying to show how everybody has their creative process or their creative path that they like to be in. It's one that works for them, so they get used to it. And he analyzes all the ways that people make creative paths for themselves and why you like that path. Then he says, well, here's what you need to do, and he gives you exercises that take you off that path consciously and put you on a different defined path of creativity. by doing that, you get to experience what it's like to be creative in that other way. And most of the times it's not comfortable, or it feels clunky, or you don't get it. But then you get used to riding on that path. So when you go back to your normal path, now you can see ways to branch off from that that might make That's you strange. Analyze things and do things a little differently. Like when a musician would write a book different than a visual artist would write a book. And I think that creative path that he wrote was, it's really good. It's out on Amazon. But I think that would be really good for a person who was like, you're getting writer's block and you just have to get out of it, just to try something different. You know, talk to somebody else. Hey, what did you do? And see what they say. And he was trying to show how it was actually useful for any kind of endeavor. Like if you were just running a project at work or something that wasn't even involved in creative writing. But you can actually use it for a lot of different things. But I was thinking that's probably the best analogy for how to you have to jump your creative path once in a while and go down another path and just to try it and see where it goes and see if you can come up with something from that.
I think what frustrates Connie so much about my writing process is she'll walk in the room and I'll be watching TV or reading a book or Facebooking or whatever. She goes, shouldn't you be working on your story? I'm like, I am. And that just drives her crazy. The whole time my brain is working through things, but I can't do it sitting at a keyboard. I got to sit and stop and let my brain wander a little bit. So I think, everybody's writing process is different.
That's an excellent question. Let me throw this one out real quick, too. So that's one I should have thought to include on my little list of three or four main questions, which is what kind of activities do you do to get these things going? Like you said, you do other activities and it's working in the background kind of. It's kind of like the computer. It's in the background, but it's still churning away. So what sort of places and things do you guys do? Chris, start us off with this one. Where do you find yourself when those ideas start and inspiration start coming?
Oh, well.
Or developing when you start thinking about them.
For me, it's tertiary thought, which is those weird little thoughts you have where one leads to another and they just end up bouncing off each other. That's like the best moment of inspiration. So you'll find those times are when you're involved in something besides writing. You were talking about putting it down on the wall. You'll see us do that when we go, and we think of that one sentence or that one part, right. Or suddenly so-and-so has to have a limp. That's us running to the wall. It's just a really big painting, and each one of those is a line.
When Andy and I were... Yeah.
I'm sorry.
Oh, go ahead. No.
I just wanted to say it's not convenient, but those tertiary thoughts come up when you're sleepy... Mm-hmm. I have insomnia. When you're in the shower,
yep.
When you're driving,
yep.
When you're just spaced out, or, it's... Your mind's not always completely there when those tertiary thoughts collide, and that's probably a good thing, as long as your mind's good enough to get it on paper.
Yeah. When I'm in a good place... That's when they usually flow. But sometimes you just can't start it without something to kickstart it. When we were writing the Black Widow story, I wrote down that blurb where he looked up and she's standing there and she's got a revolver because you can take the girl out of Chicago, but you can't take Chicago out of the girl. And I just wrote that sentence down and left it. I knew I was going to be in a story. And then when he started talking about, we have this Playa character and he's talking with it and they're going to do that, I said, there's a girl. She's a pilot too, and that's where it started stumbling from there, and it went up in the final paragraph that has that sentence in it that, she rescues him from the plane and she's ready to go, and that's their beginning of their love story. And
Spoiler alert.
Fred, any places that get you?
I rather like Chris, all day long, and the way I used to describe it to my students is it was like a blacksmith hitting a piece of hot metal and you watch the sparks fly in every direction. And that's pretty much the way my mind works. I pulled up on my cell phone the notes. I get an idea, I hear something, and I just jot it down. Example, Ombre de la Rue, Shadow of the Street. Oh, there's a nice title. Just just a phrase I heard someone use listening to, All Things Considered on the public radio or something. I'm always amused to see someone gesticulate and address, especially in exasperation, a computer as if it were a sentient animate being. That, I just thought of that watching somebody. He's sitting at a laptop and he goes, as if the computer could see, see his displeasure and so on.
Be intimidated.
Little things like that. And I just jot them down, and they always end up in one of my novels or another. I also am somewhat hard of hearing after playing in rock bands for almost 50 years. And sometimes people will say things, and what I hear is not what they said. And sometimes they're really funny turns of phrase. I can't think of one right offhand to throw out to you. But these things end up in dialogue, they end up as titles, they end up as story motifs.
That's great.
That's, you just grab everything that's floating around and write it down, and it's there for you when you need it.
Yep.
When you get writer's block, which rarely happens to me, but, gee, what am I going to write about today? And I just start thumbing through all these odd and end notes of things that I have, and, hey, it looks like fun. Let's play with that for a while. And that's where they come from.
I have the opposite of writer's block. I get writer's log jam where I have so many ideas trying to come out at once and they just get all crammed together. That drives me crazy.
I'll give you an example, not from me, but I thought this was really fascinating. There was a pulp / men's adventure / porn writer who died a few years ago. His son is a New York Times bestseller and just recently wrote a biography about him. It's called My Dad the Pornographer, yeah. They were talking about it on NPR. It made me think of it. But one of the things that they said on the interview, I think Terry Gross or one of her people talked to the son, and he was really fascinating. He said that my dad just had piles and piles of legal pads and said he would be doing anything, like watching TV, watching a movie, doing anything, and he would think, oh, that's a nice scene, and he would describe it. Like a page, a half a page on a legal pad and set it aside. Oops, sorry. And then, he's like, oh, that's a nice little bit of dialogue. And he'd write it all down on a legal pad and set it aside. So when he actually came to write a book, he'd be like going through the legal pads going, oh, that one will work. And he'd type that. And he'd go, oh, that'll work here. So he actually was building his pieces of his book separately and could just plug them in like Legos, as he went. So I thought, that's a really neat way to do it. It's different, but it's neat. Did we have any more questions? We got about 5 minutes left to wrap up our inspirational creative process here. Let's see. Somebody, did you have a question? Second one, I overlooked you.
I was going to ask. You were talking about things that I'd like to see continue.
Yeah.
Philip was taking over the Rule of the Tears.
Well, read Amber, because not only are the Amber books of Zelazny basically picking right up with the same ideas as Philip Jose Farmer's World of Tears, but one of the Amber books is actually dedicated to the main characters of one of the World of Tears books. And Roger Zelazny, the Amber books, the Corwin, the Nine Princes in Amber and Guns of Avalon, all that.
Great books.
Yeah, fantastic.
Really, you'll enjoy them.
They are amazing. And I've always said, you can trace the sort of pulp bloodlines there where you had like Robert E. Howard, Edgar Rice Burroughs early on, and then Philip Jose Farmer came along and took their sort of approach and subject matter and all and put a little different style into it and made it more like novels of the 50s, 60s, and the 70s. And then Zelazny, who actually died much before Farmer, but Zelazny then took what Farmer did and brought, Zelazny had studied like Victorian poetry and stuff like that. So he brought a sort of a poet's feel to it. So you can just see those kind of stories with the bigger-than-life heroes and heroines, you can just see them evolving from, like, Burroughs all the way through Farmer to Zelazny. I'm not sure where they've gone now. You could probably argue that Neil Gaiman, I guess Stephen Bruce too, but Bruce kind of, I love Stephen Bruce, but he's kind of doing the same sort of thing Farmer and Zelazny were doing. I don't know if he's advancing the ball down the field, use a football metaphor real quick, but I think that Gaiman obviously has taken it even further. So you can just see the family tree there, connection by connection is fascinating. So anything else before we wrap up?
I think the... I'm sorry, go ahead.
Sure.
I've written, I'm not going to publish. My husband has, but not yet. Yeah. And one thing is I've written four or five novels, and I didn't send them out. So most of it was anxiety about them not being good enough. And they really weren't, because they didn't have enough depth. There just wasn't enough character development or backstory. So when you come up with the plot ideas and the inspiration of one character, what do you do to help develop that character development? Or do you let that go as you either pants or do the outline? Or do you do a separate increment? Orson Scott Card does this huge amount of work on character development. So I was just wondering if you do anything like that.
I think what, let me start this off. I think, and all these guys will agree, I'm sure, when you start developing a character and writing a character or a story, the two questions you got to ask over and over again are why and what if. Okay, why do they do this? Okay, well then why do they do that? Okay, well, what if they did this instead? All right, well why would they do that? So if you just keep asking your questions about your characters, do it like you're interviewing a character, like you want to interview, you want to know about their life. So they start telling you one thing. It sounds weird when I'm saying it, but when you start writing about your character, they will tell you stuff about themselves that you never imagined. Just keep asking them why and what if. Yes.
I was. The Printer's Devil character, I'm working on another story, and he's a very lone wolf guy. He doesn't even have a butler, Alfred guy, who's in on it. He's the only guy. And halfway through this new story, I realized that there's a girl in the story that he kind of almost connects with, and he doesn't think, and I'm like, yeah, she's totally going to become his Margot Lane. That'll be awesome. I don't know why. And it's like, I can't see his character. He's like totally, he would be like, you want to see me romantically? It would just blow his mind. And I'm like, that's a different thing. And I didn't expect that to happen. But the more I think about it, the more I think I'll probably have to develop the character that way.
I put down an outline of generally what I'm wanting to accomplish in a story. And I do it fairly detailed. But you've got to leave it open enough because the characters have to drive it. And there's just no two ways around it. And one of Roger Zelazny, not to bring him again, one of Roger Zelazny's tricks that I always liked was he'd say, just take your character before you even start your actual book or whatever. Take your character and just write some set of one or more little scenes just to see what they would do in a different scenario. And you'll learn so much about them. You may even throw that away and never use it, or you may use it in another story later. But just do a set of scenes, you know, one or more scenes where they do stuff and you learn how they react, the things that they say, and you get to know them better. Because once you know your characters, they dictate what happens. The plot follows the character, not the other way around. And that's, to me, that's why one of the reasons I think that series are so popular is that by the time you get to a second or third book in a series, writers are so much more comfortable with their characters that the reader is more comfortable with them because everybody's settled in and kind of knows what's in store, at least, you know, not from the plot, but from the character standpoint. So you got to start with character.
I usually get the plot from the character because I'll have a certain type of character in mind. Every character is going to have that one event that A, probably got them in the book, and B, is the main big thing in their life. You know, that driver. And I come from like a psychology background, so you know I want to know how did this guy deal with his parents? How is he going to deal with authority figures? How is he going to, you know, can he tell a straight up lie? Or is he not even able to tell the white lies? And what I find an advantage in that is that as you're writing the action, then the character can come through. It can just be maybe a habit they have, like snapping their fingers or whatever. But if you have that firmly in your head, then you've got to, you know, a lot of characters just do what they want, which is good for me.
We got about 30 seconds left, Fred. You have anything you want to add to the end here and wrap us up? Bring us in for a landing.
As for plotting, I believe you were here for the previous session. I build the bridge from both sides of the river and meet in the middle. I know how it starts, I know how it ends, and I let everything else develop from both directions. to meet somewhere in the middle with some pivotal point in the plot. I don't know if that's any help to you, you know, in thinking about how you're going to set things up. And you simply allow it to grow organically. The word is pantser for a lot of people. For me, the word is organic. You just let it roll and let it flow, and you develop it from there with a certain amount of control and cultivation.
I'm watching the hive pop up on Manplex.
I've already had my turn. All right, gang. Well, we're out of time. We got to give way to the next less interesting panel. So, thanks a bunch, guys. We appreciate it very much.
Tranquility Base here. The Eagle has landed.
This has been a broadcast of the ESO Network, your station for all things geek, classic, current, and beyond. Be part of the crew at ESONetwork.com.
This has been a White Rocket Entertainment production.